This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens on radio.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. It's just me tonight. Tonight's guest is Michael Daddo from the Shannon Company in Melbourne.
Correct.
Welcome.
Thanks, Sam. Looking forward to it.
So tell me what the Shannon Company does. Let's open with that, shall we?
Right, it's the Shannon Company's vision is to inspire people to change their lives willingly and for good. So we're behaviour change specialists, but we about inspiring people to change their lives willingly and for good. As I said, and good for me is good for themselves, good for their organisation, and good for society. And the why we and good, I guess, in a permanent sense of change. Inspiring is it's about emotional connection, because I think any behaviour change in you need to, at the end of the day, get emotionally engaged with it, and you need to find ways of working around just the traditional incentives or KPIs or whatever it happens to be that people drive, laws, rules. We always break rules.
And you've been in town working with the Polytech. What sorts of organisations do you work with?
We work with various ones. We've worked with governments in Melbourne and New South Wales and Australia, the Australian government. We work with government entities like WorkSafe in Victoria, Water EPA, Sustainability Victoria. We work with organisations, charities, Alana Madeline Foundation about cyberbullying. And then we work with bigger organisations and then corporates at the end of the day, so people like Toll, Australia's largest aquaculture business, Tassal. So there's a number of different scope, I reckon, if you like to look at it.
That sounds cool. Do they think they're getting an advertising company, or do they come to you looking for something else?
Traditionally, there's probably a risk of that, because it's probably part of our heritage has been that. More recently, what we've done is, in the last 5 years, is focus very much. We're a social marketing agency, and we focus very much on behaviour change. And we set up a joint initiative with Monash University of Behaviour Works, which is about bringing the best academic learning to Australia and developing models on that. And that's co-funded with EPA, Sustainability Victoria, Office of Environment and Heritage in New South Wales, and WorkSafe in Victoria. So I guess what we've done is take the academic side very seriously, invested heavily in it. We've developed some really good tools and models to use in our work. We've taken that activity and applied to what we do some good creative thinking and communication techniques. And I think we've moved far enough away from the ad agency area. Behaviour change as an area of topic is becoming more and more important to organisations, both from an internal perspective around cultures and externally to the marketplace for competitive advantage. And that can range in context. It can be about well-being at one end and health. It can be about sustainability in an environmental context, in a very, you know, in a narrow version of sustainability. Or it can be about workplace safety and things. So there's a number of different ways that we look at it.
So how did you get into that? If we take some steps back, let's go right back to high school. What were you passionate about at high school?
I was a boat builder.
Yeah,
loved sea, loved the water and environment. Grew up around the waters in Western Port Bay in Melbourne on the Mornington Peninsula, which for me is God's country. Took up sailing at a young age, sailed my whole life, and took up boat building when I first left school. It's a passion that sort of gives me a space where, you know, I've always loved sailing more from a race, but I also love it just from a, I guess, a spiritual sense without getting it. It's always been great as a kid, you know, sailing off in the distance so you can't get away from your parents, chase dolphins.
So we're going to stop this interview now, and you're going to come and fix the rudders on my Hobie.
I'd be delighted to.
And so how long did you stick at that?
Not long. I spent just under a year. And in that process, I guess I found it was a wooden boat building course, so I loved wood and working with wooden boats and old classic boats and things. I still sail and race a classic yacht in Victoria. But I just felt it was, It lacked for me. I was a bit of a perfectionist about it. That wasn't going to work in a commercial sense for the guy I was working the apprenticeship with. So we had a bit of a fallout and took off and bunked out and went travelling and delivering yachts for a while, and then came back and got into marketing, which was my...
With a bit of sort of bravado, I can do this, or was it a...
Oh, my uncle was a great mentor of mine, and he'd been in it, and we spoke a lot about it, and I thought, oh, this would be interesting, so got into it as you do when you just follow something and see where that may end, and thankfully for me it's been very positive.
And what sort of things were you selling? Do you describe it as what? Is it selling? Or
it's selling. I reckon, you know, anyone who tells you marketing's not selling's fooling themselves. You know, we're trying to sell things. It gave me... There's two things I've always been interested in besides sailing is people. I've been quite fascinated what makes people tick. So, you know, marketing and psychology was an interesting combination for me. And I like the idea of trying to understand what motivates them to buy things and how to do things. So originally I did what most people would do in the advertising side. You'd work with clients and, you know, I sold all sorts of different things from confectionery to dog food to nappies and whatever else, cars, BMWs, that sort of stuff. So,
and eventually found yourself setting up, I think, one of the Saatchi...
I was the foundation managing director in the M&C Saatchi Melbourne office, and there was four of us of partners in M&C Saatchi Australia, and that was a terrific organisation. I spent about 7 years with them and had a ball. It was fantastic. We were incredibly successful. We were well awarded creatively, and I'd always had an ambition in the early stages of advertising to run the most creative agency in the country, and I was fortunate to do that. I enjoy the creative process. I think great ideas come from creative people and the different types you get involved, and creativity in the broadest sense, I should add. And we floated the business, and I left. Took a few months off.
You went sailing?
Hey?
You went sailing?
I didn't actually. I learned how to break in racehorses, which is, that'll sound a bit strange, but, my daughter had taken up horse riding and I had no idea how to handle animals. So I went and worked on a mate's racehorsing stud. So I spent 5-6 months doing that. So that was fantastic. And then went and worked for a client of mine on a toll road development business, around the world, Transurban, listed company in Australia. And that was fantastic as well. We'd started to look, and he was very visionary. And the CEO at the time, Kim Edwards, was an incredibly visionary man about how, which will sound strange, about how infrastructure should be developed. He had a very, what I call a holistic, sustainable view about it. You know, how it was, the architecture was done, how the water capture was done, heat capture, energy usage, how you could use recycled products to build things. So it was fascinating. So good.
And from there to the company, or have we got some other steps yet?
No. From there, I went to one of the companies we used for marketing was in Melbourne, was the Shannon Company. So they're my communications business partners in Melbourne. And when I was coming back to Melbourne, I wanted to do something that I hadn't done before. I didn't want to just sell products. I sort of got into the idea that we could do things that had a bigger meaning. That's sort of been a thread, I guess, through life. I'd been working with different charities in a not-for-profit sense and a philanthropic sense, and had an opportunity to come back. And Bill Shannon, who founded the Shannon Company, was a person I knew from a long time ago, but we had a very common view of the world that we could do things that made a bigger difference to where we live and how we live. And I think we have great skills in a creative idea development sense that can take other things another step forward and get more people involved.
So this bigger difference that you're talking about is actually sort of embodied in, is it the mission statement or something of the...
Yes.
Of the company, what we do is inspire people to change their lives willingly and for good.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a pretty well-worked sentence, isn't it?
It took about a year to craft, because creative types like to argue over every single word. You know, one stage we encouraged people, then we decided, no, inspire was a bigger call. So what we wanted was a sense of aspiration about it, but also something to capture the idea that good could be good for an individual, good for an organisation, and good for society. And we see that alignment as really important, but it can be good as in a permanent sense of change. So I can make a choice in my life that will be better for everybody in that process. And the inspiration and the willingness for us was very important because, you know, there's too many examples in the world where there's regulations in place about doing things and policies by governments, yet people still break the law. And I'm not saying in a massively wrong way. You know, I use an example of driving a car on a freeway. You know, the government might have a regulation that's 100 kilometres is the speed limit. Anything over that, you get penalised, you lose points, you get fined and all that sort of thing. And you understand that on that freeway, when I'm driving at 100 kilometres, I'm the slowest car on the freeway because everyone seems to be doing 105 or 110, which becomes acceptable behaviour. 140 is not acceptable behaviour. You know, you're basically an idiot. But that other leeway is interesting for me because it says that the social norm or the herd mentality is to do something different. When my 17-year-old son was learning to drive, that car never went over 95 k's on the freeway, you know. So my behaviour changed quite a lot. You know, if I was driving at 105, 110 normally, changed there. I thought, oh, this is interesting. Why is this going on? So I think there's ways.
You became aware of that you were the role model.
Yeah, you start to look at those things, but you also understand that whilst the law's there to change and, you know, give you reasons why you shouldn't do it, I didn't have any real reason to obey the law to that degree because I knew I was going to get penalised. Like, radar detectors aren't that accurate. The fines I was pretty comfortable with. If I got caught, good car, good driver, fine. That's what the most of the population does. But then the emotional engagement came in that I was teaching my son how to drive. It was important that he learnt the right way. And my behaviour changed accordingly. So I think there's interesting insights in the way we look at laws. You know, so people take up smoking still. People still smoke. You know, we have the most graphic, you know, plain paper packaging in Victoria now, horrible images of teeth falling out and all that, prices through the roof, banned in restaurants, can't smoke outside your building, yet people still smoke.
Woohoo, I got the gory one.
Yeah. I mean, why? You know, I think it's crazy, but they're not, for them at the moment, young kids, they might feel invincible. There's different reasons that they just don't emotionally engage in the subjects and the rules that are put around it. So for me, there was a more interesting way of trying to communicate and get people to change their behaviour. We could use all the techniques from behaviour change models that have some great stuff out of London. We worked with Behaviour Works at Monash University to devise those models. But we knew this layer of creativity was really important in how we got people to emotionally engage in it. And I'm not just talking about ads and things. I think there's the way the messaging sets up and the way you in whatever format you talk, whether it's social, packaging, PR, messaging, any of those sorts of things. But that emotional connection is a fundamental part of it.
Okay, I've got tons of questions from what you've just been talking about, so I'll try and think of a coherent order for them. You're working for good,
mm-hmm.
and you listed for good for the individual, for the company, for the customer, for society, or mm-hmm. something like that.
And in a permanent sense.
What happens when those things aren't all of those things? It might be good for the company and the individual, but not necessarily for the customer.
Well, I think we have a... we don't actually get involved in those things, to be honest. That's not our...
You turn down that sort of work?
We turn down that sort of work. If we believe there's an audience that's good for the customer, which is good for society or the community in which it operates. We have a debate around our table around the ethics of certain products and things, and there's certain companies we won't work with. There's other things that we say that person's on a journey and we'll help them on that journey because their intent is good and better to be in that space. So we'll work through that process. That often happens in food production. You know, some people, Tassal in Australia, largest aquaculture business in the country, got the WWF support for sustainability, but there will be people on the edge who don't agree with fish farming. Now, you know, I eat meat, so I'll eat all types of meat. I eat fish. I understand to feed the world, you're going to have to farm things. So let's try and make it as ethically correct as possible, as sustainable as possible, and let's help companies on those journeys to do that and make those a more a better choice for people.
Does everybody, this notion of for good, does everybody have that implicitly, or do you have to sell people on that concept as well?
I don't think you have to sell people on it. I think people understand it pretty quickly when you explain it. And I think good companies have that in their mantra anyway. I think there's a lot of, you know, a lot of corporates are maligned, but then there's also a lot of companies that do a lot of good for society in the way they do. I mean, you know, through employment, they're working harder on getting better around sustainability. They're ethically getting better at looking at their full line of sourcing food products and things. So I think, you know, good companies are on the journey. Good companies are rewarded for that journey by the customer and then in turn by the shareholders and by the listing on the share price. So I think there's a number of good examples around where it all aligns and it aligns for the better.
But there's quite a few links in that chain. If doing that sort of doing good, there's quite a few things that, you know, if before it actually increases the share value. And if somebody is managing...
Sure.
With that very much the eye on the share value, and some people argue that that is the only obligation of a business.
Sure,
we might disagree with them, but
yeah, I can agree with that. I disagree with that, but yeah, I agree with.
But there's quite a few links between doing good and necessarily making, or hopefully, making more money.
Yeah, but I guess the point is they're not mutually exclusive. I think you can do both and do those things well, and I think, you know, the better companies, I think there's good examples, and, you know, Tassal was one of them. Toll's another one, a company we work with. It's a logistics company, so that it has a big issue around, you know, carbon footprints and things. So we understand that's a problem. They're working hard at minimizing that and looking at plans to go on that journey. From a social point of view, they contribute enormously to organizations throughout Asia and Australia. Their own safety record's terrific. You know, so I think there's a lot of good that's going on in that organisation. As an industry, logistics got some inherent issues around the environmental aspects of sustainability, but it's better to work with companies that are aware of it and are working towards a better outcome.
What's the is there a fundamental difference in the approach that you would take from selling an idea that is some sort of social responsibility type thing and selling cars? Is it the same stuff?
There's in behaviour change, the things we've found over our, you know, 10-year focus now almost on behaviour change in a purest sense, is that there's a much deeper set of understanding that you need to go into the belief structures of individuals. It's not to say the other ones, you know, is in the past in advertising, you always look at behaviour and behaviour change models, but you probably did it at what I would say a slightly shallower level than what we go through and look to understand about what's involved in that. You know, so belief structures, what's the habits that are currently in play? What's the attitudes about that behaviour? Does it make them feel good? What's the role of role models, social norms? Do people have the capability to do that behaviour? You know, are they educated enough? Are they financially, physical? And have the autonomy to do it? Can they access it? So I think it's a deeper analysis. It's a different type of questioning that we do, and it leads to, I think, some significant breakthroughs and techniques that we have worked and have worked successfully for some of our clients.
Now, I've talked to a couple of marketing colleagues today.
Good.
Saying, what shall I ask him? And one of them said he's known internationally as the flipper. He's the creative thinker that's always been known to come in and flip the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that you know what they were talking about, because otherwise it's an awkward question.
I think I have some idea.
What are they talking about?
I think it's a way of, and the workplace safety is probably a pretty good example, is that you, traditionally there'll be a set of thinking that says workplace safety is all about the workplace. That we worry about our health and safety in the workplace, the motivations that are look after your mates in the workplace, look after yourself in the workplace, and all the communications are there. The deeper motivations and the beliefs that I was talking about says that that's all important, yes, but the real reason, the very real reason that you've got to be safe at work is that you can go home at night to what's really important in your life, and that's your family, your home, in whatever context that is. So take workplace safety out of the workplace and bring it home. And that's a flip in the way you think about things. It turns things around from the conventional wisdom and that.
Do you also need to do the be careful when you're climbing up a ladder? Is it both of those?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's lots of, you know, one thing about behaviour change in the programs we work with and in is there's no one simple answer. I mean, there's always a combination of techniques and ideas that come together. I guess what we say is that you can have a big thought like that, that, you know, the most important reason for workplace safety is not at work at all. It makes people rethink things, makes people get emotionally engaged in it. It gives you a more emotional license, which sensitizes a marketplace. So from that point of view, you can then go to enforcement campaigns. You can strengthen the laws because suddenly you've got a whole new license with the community about how important workplace safety is. So the regulator can be tougher on its way, enforces laws. You can have more specific information about how to improve the safety in the workplace. You can set up a consultancy division. You can do all sorts of different things because you've changed the way people are now talking about workplace safety and the way the regulator's thinking about it. They've suddenly got pride as an organisation. They've changed the way they think about it. The people who they're going to see have changed the way they think about it. They've got nowhere to argue. You know, you can't argue about someone's inherent right to go to work and come home safely. You know, and that's... I think we should all be able to do that, you know.
So in that example, how are you measuring the success? Is it about how many people fall off ladders, or is it are you looking at people's perceptions of workplace safety?
All of that. We look at results, and you know, it's the construct of that campaign and program is quite complex. I mean, there are workplace inspectors out in the workplace. They inspect, they police, they give advice. There's a number of campaigns targeted at specific audiences, from kids, you know, telling them to speak up. It's okay to speak up about things. Don't feel under pressure to lose your job. There's a number of campaigns in that area. It's return to work campaigns. So there's a whole list of activity that goes on. There's information websites, as I said before. All of that together with the laws and enforcing them and, you know, the PRing of the recalcitrant who's being pinged and all that sort of stuff, has led, you know, to a significant decline in claims per thousand, which is about people having injuries and then claiming on the regulator. So, it's about best practice. The premium rates come down because good companies are rewarded. And the escalation of workplace safety, if you like, as an area what concerns the community has gone up. So the perceptions of it. And then we track the ads in a traditional sense as well and calls, all that sort of stuff. So there's a number of data points that we look to see how successful the work is.
When you're working up a story and you talk a lot about the narrative,
mm-hmm.
is it a story in the traditional sense, a beginning, a middle and an end and an increasing tension and all that sort of stuff?
No, I think the story in the traditional sense is a technique we would apply to the narrative. The narrative is a piece that we like to think of as where strategic thought and creative thinking starts to come together. It's an emotional piece. It should form an emotional connection with your audience. It's a piece you want to read. You find it intriguing. It's a persuasive piece because it has facts through it as well. So it's a blend of the rational, the facts, but also the emotional connection begins to be formed in that story. It's a persuasive piece of writing. Now, that piece may never see the light of day, but it's a fundamental go-to piece for any messaging, communications campaigns. We like to think of the piece that you could, it could be an editorial piece. It could be a speech, that sort of thing. So it's something that grabs an audience in its own right, but it also then allows us to spin off and do different aspects. You can take parts of it. You could do a version of it, you know, an edited version that's more film orientated, whatever.
And you build up, it's because in that sort of campaign, it's with behavior change, it's you're hoping for an ongoing emotional
Absolutely.
Connection.
Yeah.
It's not just when I'm watching the ad, I'm going to remember not to climb up an unsafe ladder. Workplace safety is kind of interesting because it's, when we've been doing the work, when we started talking about sustainability across mm-hmm. the institution at the Polytech, one of the things that we were doing was we called it the chainsaw scenario, where people were taught how to act sustainably, recycle the oil and so on. But on the first day of the job, they're busily doing those things, and the boss comes and says, stop mucking around, chop the trees down. You just, you know, we're here to get this work done.
Yeah.
What's the response in that situation? And then on the second day, you're told to chop down the last of a cowrie tree. You know, what do you do in that situation? And we've been using that in every discipline to talk about, you know, what is that? What, you know, what are the skills that you're going to learn as well? But what are those sort of lines that you're not going to cross? And then what are you going to do about them? And we're talking to people in architecture and building, and they said, oh, but on a building site, you do what you're told.
Mm.
You can't just decide, I think we'll build this skyscraper out of straw because that'll be,
yep,
that'll be more sustainable because it's going to fall down and people get hurt. And then we sort of like eventually got to workplace safety because their take was on a building site, you do what you're told, full stop. But on a building, in terms of workplace safety, it's like the one case where you're actually required to be outside that and you are holding that. Do you think, and my premise has been that I haven't managed to get much traction on, is that sustainability is really an extension of workplace safety. That it's that, you know, it might not be someone's going to fall off the ladder and hurt themselves right now, but the asbestos you're hiding in that landfill is.
Yep. I would say, you know, it depends how you're defining sustainability. And, you know, because of our work with, you know, Dr. Barry Law's business and the sustainability company in New Zealand, you know, we define sustainability in that holistic sense. So it is about a social, environmental, political type of aspect. There's a fourth one there. It'll come to me in a second. And it's very definitely workplace safety is in that area, in both of social responsibility. It certainly has an economic impact because of its productivity is hurt more by lost time injury than by any union stoppages and those sorts of things. So I think there's a real imperative for companies to be very strong on that space for a number of reasons. So if you've got economic, social reasons for it, environmental reasons are probably a little bit more interesting in that they're not quite the right space for it. There's a political imperative to deliver for it, for workplace safety, because that's legislated. So you've got to obey the law and, you know, you can then go above that. So for me, workplace safety is very much part of sustainability. As long as we're not trying to pin sustainability in the pure environmental sense of the word, because I don't think that's how we would think of sustainability. You know, an organization's sustainability is bigger than just the environment. The environment's fundamentally important to it, but the economic viability, the social impact of that business and the political impact of that business is fundamental as well.
One of the – I went away and looked up the home – is it called the Homecoming campaign?
Yes.
You know, I liked some of the lines. My reason for staying safe at work. What's yours? Workplace safety doesn't happen when you're at work. It affects your whole family.
Mm.
And it is that very much putting that in. So I was just wondering, what occurred to me is, how can we scale that kind of thinking to, instead of just affecting your whole family, it's affecting the community or the global community or the whole environment. What I'm saying is, can we borrow this success of this workplace safety thing to start thinking about behavior change and sustainability? Because I get frustrated when people are using sustainability and the sort of behavior change they're working on is recycling in the waste bins at work, or make sure you climb up the stairs, which have to happen, but aren't going to get us there on their own.
Yep.
So what do you think about this sort of using that approach on a wider behavior change?
The thinking and the idea of forming an emotional connection, which is what underpins that thinking in many ways, is valid for sustainability. It absolutely is valid. I mean, you know, sustainability is not always just about us right here and now. It's about a generational movement. It's, you know, my kids, are they going to be able to swim in a nice, clean water that I grew up sailing around, chasing dolphins and things? Are they going to have that same pleasure? Are they going to be walking through, you know, appallingly as it was in Melbourne the other day in the Port Phillip Bay, there's rubbish on all the beaches and things. You know, there is an emotional connection to how we want our lives to be lived and the generations to grow up in. You know, if you're in China and you don't see the sun properly for a period of time in Beijing because of the pollution, people don't want their kids brought up with that. You know, if you're an expat going there, people talk about that. Why would I do that? So I think the family, the emotional bond I have with the family and how they're going to live their lives, the well-being for my children, what I hope for my children and their success is very important in how we think about it and how we engage in it.
But it's not just behaviour change that's about your children. It's your behaviour, how that's affecting that family in China. The smog in China is making stuff cheap stuff for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're doing the wrong things at times by, you know, perpetuating that demand for those products and things. But I think there is issues in how you address it. I guess the idea is that you can take an emotional reason for re-looking at the way you live your life in a sustainable manner. Now, how far you take that is going to be dependent on all sorts of things. What we need to do is make things more economically viable so it's accessible. You know, governments have tried incentive programs. You know, in Australia, when we had the drought, we had and actually, the drought's a very good example in Australia. I think we became the best water conservers in the world at the end of the 10-year drought. Now, was that about our sustainability? Absolutely it was, you know. We became good because we understood that as a collective we could make a big difference. At the start of it, we thought, well, what's me turning the tap off going to do to a dam that's, you know, four times the size of Sydney Harbour sitting up in the Dandenongs or whatever? So it is, I think, really important that we understand that when we bring to understand the bigger social issues around it, are we going to have water enough in the future? Are we going to be able to do that, that we can all actually pull together? Combination of regulations, combination of understanding exactly what we could do, information, how to shower with a bucket, how to do egg timers, how to take the save up your dirty laundry and do one wash, save up for the dishwasher, all those techniques, all sorts of different things that we needed to do about information and education on how to conserve water, plus the incentives, plus the costing and all that sort of stuff, makes a big difference. There's no one simple answer, but the emotional connection to it and that we're not going to have enough water is a powerful one.
Is that relying on a lesser life, a threat of a lesser life, a fear?
It's a threat, yeah. I think there's, you know, there's always, I think, you know, we talk a lot about fear and hope in equal measure and how that works. You know, there's the fear of, in the homecomings, out of dad not coming home, and then there's the joy and the hope of dad coming home. So same with the water thing. There's the fear of not having it, and there's the hope that we will solve the problem and have water for the future. So I think there's always that power, that point, and I think we use very much understanding that shift in thinking that hope is a much more powerful motivator than fear at the end of the day, that we think we can do better, we can hope we can do better, and we can find ways to do that.
Do you always need to go through the loop of fear?
Interesting question. I don't. I think it works in certain spaces. You know, smoking, the fear of dying and things, and then losing your loved ones. You know, smoking for a long time was about the personal journey. It's a great campaign Quit did in Victoria about, you know, the little girl who sits at the end of the bed and dad's missing out on time with his child. You know, it's a really strong pull. So there's always fear, but you've got to give some sense of hope. If I stop smoking, I'm going to be better for it. If you gave no hope at the end of the fear, why would I bother?
If you were trying to do if you were engaged to do something on climate change, mm-hmm. how many pictures of polar bears standing on tiny bits of floating ice would we see?
I think we try and get away from that. I think you've got to take the. I think the problem is that's still too remote for a lot of people. You know, as much as a good shot of a polar bear is great, and, you know, the lone polar bear is wrong because one polar bear. So, you know, maybe if there's a baby polar bear, you might get more emotionally engaged. So that's one step. But I think the real trick is, how is it going to relate to me back at home and things? Because at the moment, I don't think there's enough. It's hard. You know, we're a self-interested thing. Our belief structure's grown that way. You know, I think it's important that we try and bring it back to that family. And so what's really important is, will my kids ever have the opportunity to see a polar bear in the wild? Will my family ever have the water to drink? Will they have the clean beach to play on, swim in the ocean without worrying about the pollution, the air that they breathe? The more you can bring it home, I think, and it's not always the answer, but a lot of it is in that space, because that's where a lot of our motives are driven from. You know, I work to provide. I work for a better life for myself and my family. All our motivations are around that aspect, that social aspect. So somehow if you can bring it into that space, then you're in a much richer area for people to listen to the message and take the message on board. But, you know, I think it's important. It's never going to be just about a clever ad or anything else. There's got to be more to it than that, and there's got to be a lot of more.
You used the quote, "The only thing stronger than fear is hope," which is from The Hunger Games, President Snow. But then he goes on to say, "A little hope is effective, a lot of hope is dangerous."
It's dangerous for him in that context, because too much hope for him would override his whole premise of the Hunger Games. So in the context of that film, too much hope is dangerous.
But I think it, I was thinking about that this afternoon, and I think that that still applies to the sort of behaviour change stuff that we're looking for in sustainability, because too much hope is this sort of deluded view that it'll all be all right. We're going to invent something that's going to have unlimited fuel.
Oh, true. If hope becomes the escape for an obligation right now, then absolutely. Hope connected to what the individual can do now and coupled with what we can do now is the way it's realistic. So, you know, that's what I said before. Hope can't be an artificial hope. It can't be a fluffy hope. It's got to be a realistic hope. And then you've got to prove that that makes a difference. And I think that's one of the great techniques in the emotional engagement. If it's really close to you and you, dad coming home, dad working safe, that's close and accessible. You understand the hope involved in that. If it's about me turning off taps and saving water, I understand that. So me stopping cigarettes early enough that I don't have risk of lung cancer, or reduce the risk of lung cancer and things, that's hope that you have control over. Fluffy hope is ridiculous, and I don't think that's the right space.
But how then? I'm taking that to mean not just the in the direct behaviour change, but as a, you know, a general rule for life, if you like. Can we use that to, I'm going to say protect kids, but it's not the right, protect's not the right word. But if kids are seeing on TV pictures of Syria or wherever else things are going, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing that we can do, because you're talking about hope being related to actions that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these terrible things happening that we don't have any control over, or at least very little.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's an interesting point. I mean, the Middle East and all that is driven a lot by social media and the changes that happened there. And that, you know, right or wrong, nearly all the changes of regime there were driven a lot by the social media aspects of things. Now, I think that is a collective hope that we can make something better. Does it need to spread globally? In some cases, it does. You know, I think that's fair and reasonable. You know, if you go back to Geldof and his music thing, there was hope there that we could rid the world of AIDS and things, you know, that if we did enough and started to do things, we could make a big difference. And we can make a big difference when we're all there. Social media gives you another vehicle to do that. Has someone tried to harness that from Australia's point of view? Do we have enough connection, emotional connection to the troubles in Syria at the moment? Maybe not. If we did, maybe we would change the way we thought about it and got involved.
We've been talking over the summer with people from the Marine Mammals Conference that was big Marine Mammals Conference here before Christmas. And one of the things we quite often found ourselves talking about was the role of the Save the Whales campaigns and the, you know, the badges and that sort of stuff. Is it important that we get young people engaged in those sorts of, you know, campaigns? Should it is? Yeah. Did you get kids wearing WorkSafe badges? Is there something about getting the, you're making the connection, but can we start that early?
I think you know, there's an old thing about share, care and dare, you know, care, share and dare, care enough to share it, and then share, no, it was right the first time, share, care, dare, share the issue, care enough about it to do something and dare to do something. You know, there's a lot of social media activism that nothing comes of. I think the more you can bring the activity from the online into the offline world, and a good example was the Middle East, they had enough of the issue and they did dare to do something, they changed a regime. I think anything that allows us to feel like more people are involved and go to the norms, that the norm is we don't like whales being massacred in the Southern Ocean on our doorsteps. If we want to do more about that, then show you care about it and express that. If you feel there's a lot of movement towards it, then great. And I think you can get people to do those things. I think that sort of symbolism becomes very important. It's worked, you know, there's pink for breast cancer, there's pink ribbons, white ribbons for violence against women and things. I think it's a way of normalising it and such like. You know, we have Movember in around the world now. It's another way of displaying something that you're passionate about and you're getting involved in things. So I think those things help to the idea that a social norm is at play and that there's lots of people are doing it and therefore we feel comfortable being involved in it and then garners greater and greater support.
Is it important that people are engaged in actively doing something, even if it's virtual. And what I'm thinking about is also from Melbourne, the Melbourne Trains game, which so many ways to die with a cute song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You didn't do that, did you?
No. Great bit of work.
Why does that work?
I think it works, and again, you know, whether it's changed behaviour or not at the moment, I don't know. I don't think you'd ever ask one piece of communication to do that. What it did do was gain a huge amount of influence and got people talking about it and becoming aware of it. If at the same time you changed a physical sense around railway stations, you put more guards on and cameras and all sorts of things, then you might have had a real change in what the death rate is and the accident rate is. I don't know the statistics around that. I'd be interested to see it. But what I do know is that gained enough interest and enough influence that lots of people got involved in talking about it. And sometimes you need that public pressure to start to change other things, to enforce environment regulations, environment in this sense, I mean a physical environment about change, regulations around it and other things that will directly intervene around the behaviour. You know, an example for us is we did a lot of the industry superfund work in Australia. Now, that campaign helped influence regulation to change that to ensure that Australians had a better outcome for retirement. So sometimes I think those things, just by the weight of popular support, the pressure they can put on legislators, can change what we know in the intervention suite that's going to influence behaviour and change behaviour, and the combination of it will influence lawmakers to do more, people to do more about the physical environment they put in those places, other things. So, you know, I don't, it'd be interesting to see what the whole statistical wrap-up of that campaign is, but for what it was set out to do, I think it was terrific.
And it got people all around the world thinking about, about train safety. Is this work a science or an art?
Both. And I think we work very hard at understanding the science behind it, the combination of interventions that need to be in play, but then applying the art, if you like, is around the idea and the creativity to engender the emotional connection. I don't think you can divide the two. I think it's very much that way inclined. I think the science is fantastic. The academics have been amazing in what they've got. They're generous in sharing the learning and understanding. A company like ours takes it, finds a way of practically applying it and using it for the benefit. And in doing that, I think we add a creative idea to it, a creative slant on it, if you will, that allows us to gain what we think is a lot of always this missing emotional connection piece. And I think that's a really important aspect of it in the way it gets communicated. And it doesn't, as I said before, it doesn't need to be an ad. It might be the social media piece. It might be a message. Way the message is constructed and presented. It might be a speech, could be a number of different things. But I think that's really important. So art and science, for me, is a healthy and interesting mix.
So you find yourself talking to psychologists?
Yeah, psychologists, lots of people way smarter than me, and academics and things. Behaviour Works, as I said before, is a group. We have a couple of PhD, postdoctorate guys, and then six or seven PhD guys working there who bring out world's best people to Australia, like a study of habits. There might be a study of policy and how that influences it, the role of incentives in behaviour change. So there's lots of different dynamics to this, and I think the more we learn and the more we work with the academics, the more we see potential for taking some of their techniques and their learnings and applying it in different ways.
What's the role of incentive? I'm thinking about things like nudge, which is not quite an incentive, it's more of a make things easy to do the right way.
Yep.
And one of the criticisms of that is if you take it away, that design, people haven't actually made a change themselves, they were just doing it the easy way. Is the same true for incentives, that if the incentives go away, then the behaviour change stops?
No, I think the, you know, when you study the behaviour, and one of the things we did study was habits, and habits formation and habit breaking, or vice versa, however you want to look at it, is a really important thing to understand, because habits are by far and away the best predictor of behaviour. And to break a habit can take a long time and can be quite difficult to do. So incentives can help you change and break, intervene, if you're going to force an intervention into the habit to get start a new behaviour. How long you need to leave that incentive in place until a new habit's formed is an interesting question, and probably depends on the behaviour you're after. and things. So there's some very, very good examples globally of where incentives have worked amazingly well. In South Africa with Discovery and about insurance and health incentives around it has been phenomenally successful in South Africa. There's incentive. You can see people try that idea of habit for rate breaking, you know, the Special K challenge for 2 weeks or the 100-day challenge in gambling in Victoria. There's different ways people found it and give an incentive at the end to do that and the motivation to do it. So they're proven to be successful. How long you need to be in place to a new habit starts, it's a bit more.
So the big question is, what's it going to take to break the big habit, our addiction to carbon?
That is a big question. Well, there's two parts of that. I mean, I think the other thing that talks in behaviour change to you quite strongly is the perception of capability to do something about it. And capability comes up, or control, if you like, is around, you know, physical, education, financial, and do I have the autonomy to do it? It was interesting in that space, you know, with water, and I'll just go back to water for a minute, is that people, when originally people were confronted with the drought, is I can't do anything about it because I'm just one person in one house. But when people saw that they could contribute and the collective could make a big difference, then they felt they had the power to do it and do things well, and they had the education to do it. They knew what to do. Still, you know, carbon was one of those interesting ones, and is that I don't think everybody feels that they, you know, you hear that argument all the time, you know, well, China's belting along or India's coming up, you know, what are we going to do here? You know, in Australia, you know, that was a political argument, you know, we shouldn't lead the world because we're not going to make a big enough difference to it. You know, well, if everyone took that attitude, no one's going to do anything. So my view is this, you've got to find ways for us to understand that we can all contribute to reducing our carbon footprint, and collectively that will make a difference. One of the real issues with that is it can't make a difference right now. It's going to make a difference in the future. So how do we bring the future closer to people understand and visualise that impact?
We're not very good at that at all, are we? No. If the people that we're making decisions on behalf of are 50 years' time, it's very, very difficult to put them on anything equal footing.
In a funny way, we confront that with superannuation and savings and pensions and things, and that, you know, you don't realise the benefit of this. You know, for a young kid, you know, my son is 19 and the other one is 22, you know, what are they doing on the weekend? They want to spend money and have a party and have a good time. You know, they want to put an extra $20 in superannuation because that's only going to impact them in 40 or 50 years. So I was like, I'll worry about that later. You know, I've got time to worry about that. So how you make that relevant to them now and give them techniques and get them to understand that takes a whole lot of different programs. It takes trial and error to see what works and doesn't work. And we have that same issue with the environment. If, you know, if I don't do something now, if I don't, you know, buy a diesel or a hybrid now, you know, conserve my water, put solar panels on my roof, what role model am I playing to my children about the environment? B, is what's difference is it going to make really down the track? If we all did it, what would that do? You know, sometimes we've got to help people understand that collectively we can do amazing things and make big differences in that. And, you know, there is some good technology out there to start to do that. You know, the Polytex wind turbine type thing where they can get more domestic use in remote places and things. They're great, you know, so.
For a business person, there's an awful lot of left-leaning words I'm hearing that you're saying. Is it just you, or is it the company as a whole?
I think, traditionally I probably come out of a very right side of family and commercialism and capitalism and things, but I've always felt that we had a obligation and a responsibility to do things that we can for other people less fortunate than that. Is that left-leaning? Well, maybe probably a little bit, but I think it's a growing thing. I think people like Gates and that, I think the world's realising there's probably a way where capitalism and a more social agenda can play together in a common area. As an organisation, we are probably more left than we are right, and unapologetically that way inclined, because I think some of the great things have come from different areas in that space, and I think it's wrong for either side to say that either side doesn't contribute in the right way. You know, unions have given us great things, safety, time with families and all those sorts of things, equal rights in many ways with female pay and that sort of stuff. So it's wrong to just brandish unions as troublemakers and productivity limitations when they actually have a great agenda and they've got some great people thinking about a bigger, more sustainable in the broader sense of the word, countries. Similarly, on the right, there's some terrific people who similarly think the same way. It's important that people come home from work safe. But, you know, safety and productivity aren't mutually exclusive. They actually come together in a very strong way. You know, the less people having work time injuries, the more productive my business is. So I think there's combinations and arguments both sides.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Geez, that's an interesting question. I probably think more of a person with a conscience who can make a difference. Well applied. I don't. An activist for me implies someone more who is a lead agitator, if you like. I'm probably not that way inclined. I'm probably more about someone who knows how to use my skills and organisational learnings, and I guess learning along the track record of how to get a better outcome.
What challenges have you got for the next couple of years?
Well, there's some big challenges. I think there's challenges. There's the working with our clients. There's some big challenges around their issues, which are society issues. So, you know, I think there's still ensuring adequacy in retirement is a big issue in Australia, and we work with our clients on that. Getting us to eat more fish and eat more healthily is a big issue in Australia. We work with our clients on that. WorkSafe is a big issue and continues to be a big issue. We work with our clients on that. I think there's always going to be a space where we're aligned, and that's what we look for, is alignment and meeting some of those big social challenges with our clients and helping them and their businesses and their communities. And, you know, I think it's one of the things I have trouble with, if too far left and extreme is wrong. It's like, you know, there's two extremes, and you don't, either extreme is wrong completely. In the middle is all these shades of grey, and I think, you know, to hurt companies that are trying to do the right thing, are bringing better production methodologies and things, and to say that you just can't, you know, use pork as an example, you just shouldn't eat pork. Now, that's one aspect. If I stop a company that's on a journey to be the best and most sustainable pork producer, animal welfare, all those good things get ticks off and that sort of thing, then why wouldn't I help a company do that? Because it's helping a local community and 100,000 people. You know, I don't see the point in destroying all those things. So I think there's plenty of good challenges. I think there's our challenge as a business is to keep finding other businesses and other partners who share our vision for inspiring people to make change willingly and for good. And the more we can do that, the better, because I think collaboration is the only way to solve some of these issues. Well, no one company is ever going to have the right, or no one person is ever going to have the solution. You know, you need to, there's great minds around how you access those minds and collaborate with those people is exciting as well.
So last question then is, what should those great minds out there that are listening to the show, both in Dunedin and nationally and internationally, is there any, like, one bit of advice you'd have for them, or a thing you'd like them to do?
I think the greatest thing we can always do is change the world in some shape or form for the better. And if we can find ways to contribute to that in whatever way we can, then we should do that and seek those opportunities. And no matter what role we are in life, we all have the ability to contribute to that in some shape or form. So I think we should always look for that opportunity to do that, and go for it as hard as we can in whatever capacity that we have.
Thank you very much for that. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who didn't turn up tonight, and me, Samuel Mann. He's got a good excuse. Tonight's guest was Michael Daddo from the Shannon Company in Melbourne. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. You can find us on Facebook and Flickr and everywhere else that we can get the show to. You can listen on iTunes. That was Sustainable Lens for the 6th of February, Waitangi Day. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.